Hey, football fans, it's Patrick Peterson, former three-time All-Pro NFL cornerback, and now the new host of First and Pod, the podcast that breaks down every game, every week, with new episodes dropping every Monday and Friday mornings. Plus, I'll be highlighting key matchups for DBs around the league on Patrick's Corner. Be sure to subscribe to First and Pod on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Shoppers John Deere Reaction Monday on Sports Radio 610. Here's Payne and Pendergast.
All right, appreciate everybody hanging through the break with us. What's wrong with C.J. Stroud? We're going to talk about that in just a second here. I will tell you, when I say what's wrong with him, I saw a video from Chris Sims this weekend, which was putting a lot of C.J.'s issues on the surroundings as opposed C.J. himself.
Yeah,
and I think both things can be true. I will tell you, Seth, the one thing that I'm seeing a lot of over the last 48, 72 hours that needs to stop, and it won't because it's Twitter. If anything, I'll get copied on more of these now because I'm requesting they stop. These graphics that get put up with CJ's stats from this season in a column next to, say, Blake Bortles' stats from his second season in the NFL.
Oh,
and they pick
I
out
hadn't seen that. Yeah,
Blake Bortles, I've seen a lot of Trevor Lawrence. It's basically cherry-picking a bunch of quarterbacks who are generally, have been, since CJ came into the league, generally been viewed as inferior to CJ Stroud. Blake Bortles, obviously inferior to CJ Stroud. I don't even know if Blake Bortles is in the league anymore.
Well, Bortles, the thing about Bortles was that he amassed a lot of garbage time yardage. It was like a record for yards when playing from behind and all that, yeah.
In his
Trevor
second
Lawrence,
year.
I'll listen to Trevor Lawrence, because I think this has been my issue. I long said, well, look, I'm not interested in making excuses for Trevor Lawrence because of his injuries that he's played through. And yet now I find myself saying, well, maybe CJ's a little banged up. I don't know. He's been playing through something. So I'm a bit of a hypocrite there. But I also think that, like with Blake Bortles, or excuse me, with Trevor Lawrence, Trevor Lawrence also had offensive line issues and protection issues and everything else. So it's really hard to separate some of CJ's play from the poor pass protection, the lack of speed in the wide receiving corps now especially, and everything else. The complete and total absence of a run game is really, I think, the most devastating thing, because CJ's still done some really good things. It's just a lot of it's on third and long because they're in third and long all the time because they can't run the football.
Yeah, the only thing I would say, like, specific to Trevor Lawrence, and Trevor Lawrence in his second year got the Jags to the postseason, went on that great run at the end of the year, you know, where they won like 5 out of 6, and he was very good for that stretch. The only thing I would say, and like making an injury excuse for CJ, is that Trevor Lawrence never touched the level that CJ was last year. Like, Trevor Lawrence has never been mentioned in conversations about top 5 or even barely top 10 quarterbacks, whereas CJ came into this year and a lot of people were expecting a top 5 quarterback performance, and they haven't gotten that. So with CJ and the injuries, I don't view them as much as excuses as reasons. Like, if it were to turn out at the end of the year that he went in for some sort of procedure right after the year was over, I would feel relief that we would maybe now have an explanation for him missing some of the easy throws, or at least easy for him. He made them look easy last year. Like, he, in that Baltimore game, he missed. There was a period in the first half where he missed like 4 passes in a row. Well, no, then he missed 4, like 4 bad incompletions, and the only completion in that stretch was one that maybe should have been intercepted if Dalton Schultz doesn't snare the ball and moss the guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he missed them to everybody. He sailed one to Nico. He sailed a wheel route to Joe Mixon. He missed John Mechie on a pass. Like, it wasn't one of these things where he's throwing it to a guy. Like, if he had missed 3 straight passes to Deontay Johnson, if he were active in that game, I'd have been like, all right, well, they're just not on the same page. You know, these are guys who were wide open, and he's sailing these balls. So, if there were to be something after the year, Seth, that were medical, I would be a lot more relieved about some of the things that I do think are CJ's fault. He's got to make those throws.
The thing that where I'm open to injuries being at least part of the explanation, it goes all the way back to his misfire to Tank Dell in the Detroit game, where it's sometimes when a quarterback just doesn't feel right, that's where there's a little bit of hesitancy to pull the trigger on some of the big-time throws. And on that play, it just felt like, man, he waited too long to make the decision, and then he did not, and then he didn't throw a good ball on top of it. The game the other day, the interception that he threw, man, that was going to be a risky throw. And he was out on the run, scrambling. But I feel like he's regressed a little bit, because like on that play, he had time to plant his foot and throw it, but he kind of threw it on the run because there was pressure. But all right, does he now feel that pressure more intensely because he's been hit so many times and because he's banged up because of those hits? It's just, it's not an excuse for the sum total of it all, but it would at least be a reasonable explanation for why there's some things that just aren't right. There's just too many times where, even on the incompletion of Dalton Schultz in the flat, where Dalton was wide open.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
Yes, it's a tight pocket. Yes, Laremy Tunsil was getting trucked backwards badly, and CJ was getting hit as he threw it. But I feel like there was a version of CJ that takes a half step to get away from it and then throws it, or steps up in the pocket a little bit to make that throw. And I just don't know if it's either a lack of timing or trust or whatever else it is. Some of these hard throws, he's not making any easier on himself. Yeah. And it's just everything's off. Now, Dalton Schultz didn't get out of the backfield as quickly as he normally would on that, because Laremy's getting trucked backwards and Dalton's checking for the blitz. There's just so many things that are off with the tight ends, with the wide receivers, with the offensive line, that it's some of it might be injury, but some of it also might be that CJ is just his clock is screwed up now.
This has been the hardest season in recent memory for me to watch other teams play football, especially other teams that run this system to play football. Like I can watch other games, you know, during seasons like 2021 or 2022 and not get angry, because the Texans are just a bad football team. You know, like it's whatever. It's a rebuild. I know the Texans need a lot more pieces to even be comparable to these other teams that I'm watching play. But, you know, I'm watching Green Bay and Minnesota yesterday, and I'm watching Minnesota just operate with Sam Darnold and with Cam Akers making big plays at the end of that. Cam Akers had a touchdown, and he had the catch that sealed the deal, that basically made it so that Minnesota could just take knees. He was the guy that was in at the end of the game, not Aaron Jones. It was Cam Akers. So there were a few things to get a little upset about in that game. But the main thing, because it's not just that game, it's other games. It's teams that aren't even considered very good NFL offensive teams, but at least they're operating in a way that doesn't make everything look hard. Everything looks hard. With even the plays that they convert, you know, even the third and 15s that they convert, it's usually something of CJ. There's usually some element of CJ having to navigate some massive difficulty in order to do it and put a cape on in order to convert those plays. That's what's so infuriating to watch, is it's now the Texans are a relevant team. They're a playoff team. We've seen good offense at times, mostly last season with this team. How is it that these other teams that are very average offensively at least make their, at least on first and 10, they hand it off and like, wow, there's an easy 7-yard run. That never happens with the Houston Texans.
Honestly, the Cam Akers scenario and the fact that they traded him away is still so puzzling to me. I mean, you look at him versus Damian Pierce. It's not like Cam Akers is having an all-pro season or anything. And he's only averaging 3.9 yards per attempt. But he's got 98 rushing attempts to Damian Pierce's 21.
I'll sum it up. So you can put him on. You can put him on the field.
Yeah.
You can't put Damian Pierce on the field. You know why I know that? They're not putting Damian Pierce on the field.
Well, that's Cam Akers has 12 receptions to Damian's 2.
Right.
Cam Akers at the very least provides you some kind of dual threat at the running back position. That and maybe, you know, with the Texans, he's going to have to manufacture a lot of that yardage, but I feel like he's at least capable of it. Compared to the two-headed monster they have for backup running back of Ogunbowale and Damian Pierce, it's not a great backup running back situation.
No.
But the run game in total, and this is where, the whole thing with Bobby Slowick was, we said all offseason, all right, it's very promising. He still has to prove that he can engineer a good rushing attack. Now I'm like, okay, good would be awesome. A good rushing attack would be incredible. God. But we know that it's not.
Average would be good.
Games in which Joe Mixon has over 100 rushing yards, we're still saying, like, man, they did not run the ball well.
Right.
Because it's Joe Mixon has a couple big runs, but, man, they're not churning out yardage. And it's putting the offense in third and long, second and long way too often. That's one of the things that I know individually the offensive linemen are not playing well, obviously. But there's plenty of teams that run the ball better than the Texans who have journeyman offensive line across the board, or at least one or two really good linemen, but not other guys to write home about. There's a disjointedness that it's impossible for me not to look at the whole operation and say, at the end of the day, Bobby Slowick's not getting enough out of these guys.
Yeah.
I don't care. As angry as I get at individual offensive linemen, to be as bad as they are in the run game and to be as bad at they are at some of the simple things in the passing game, when you couple that with the tight ends and the wide receivers and everything else, is there a position group on the offense right now that you feel good about? Even before Stephon Diggs and Tank Dell got injured, you still didn't feel great about the wide receiving group other than Nico Collins.
Right. Well, you and I led into this. I would have said quarterback, but the lead into this segment was what's wrong with CJ right now?
Right. Yeah. I don't.
And just to be very clear, so it doesn't get misconstrued or twisted, I still feel great about CJ Stroud as the future quarterback of this football team.
Yeah.
There's a big element, and I was feeling it during that Ravens game, and I was seeing it during the Ravens game on social media and just talking to people. I think there's a big element for people right now that feels like, A, this offense ain't getting fixed this year, and B, everybody just needs a big reset, especially on the offensive side of the ball.
Look, this is where, when you talk about, there's just so many things off that you can make an excuse for somebody. You can make an excuse for somebody on the team almost every single down. And I'll criticize Bobby sometimes for not attacking the middle of the field enough, but then you get into that game on Wednesday, and there's times where, yeah, they're supposed to be quick hitters over the middle and mesh concepts and stuff, but even versus a four-man rush, where CJ's taking the ball in the gun, taking two steps backwards, and he's getting hit at the top of his drop when he's trying. Like, the defensive linemen are coming free so quickly and ferociously up the middle at times that you can't even throw over the middle. It's just so frustrating. Yeah. When I'm watching on TV, I wanted to blame CJ for not getting rid of the ball quickly enough. But then I'm watching the game, and, well, okay, yeah, he could. He's got Xavier Hutchinson open on a target, but Kyle Van Noy is on CJ as he would be starting his motion. And it's just, you can't function that way.
Right.
You just can't function that way.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Like, what, on the offensive side of the football, what group do you feel good about right now? I probably, when healthy, even when they weren't moving the football all that great with Tank and Stephon Diggs both still healthy, I felt good about that room. You know, like, those are three good receivers.
Well,
now it's Nico and a bunch of dudes, you know. And
the thing about when they had the three guys out there, or just even two of them, they were still affecting the offense, even though the passing game, or affecting the defense, where the passing game wasn't what you wanted to be. But, man, they're facing cover two all the time, and you should be able to run the ball versus that. You should be able to complete short stuff, but they couldn't even do that because of the ineptitude of the blocking. And by the blocking, I'll say by the offensive line, the tight ends, the running backs, all of it. And then you add on to that, you know, Joe Mixon, I could make some of the same excuses for Joe Mixon that I make for CJ Stroud.
Yeah.
I don't think Joe Mixon's always doing a great job of making the right read. But then you're like, my knee-jerk reaction is, but yeah, he's hardly ever getting good looks in front of him. And I think he and CJ both at times are pressing too hard to try to get the big shots. And it's just a quagmire.
I don't feel great about any room on that side of the football. And yet I feel like if they fix the offensive line room, that has an effect on all the others.
Yeah.
You know, I saw a cut. There's a cut out there that I think a lot of, if you're a football fan and you're on social media, you've probably seen. I think it's from the draft, or it was after Jim Harbaugh was named the head coach of the the Chargers, and I think it was at the draft or the combine when all the coaches do availabilities at the press conference, or they sit down for breakfast with the reporters there in the room. And Harbaugh has a great cut, and this is he kind of tipped his hand as to what they were going to do in the draft, because they end up drafting Joe Alt, the tackle from Notre Dame, to go with Rashawn Slater as their other tackle. So they got their bookend tackles for the next several years. And he said that basically, and I'm totally paraphrasing here, but offensive line is the one position that everybody else is dependent upon. You know, the other positions, they're not dependent on you. I mean, there is some interdependency with each position, but none more so than that group. And that is why we're going to build through the offensive line. And I think in terms of intentionality, I think the Texans have made an effort to do that in the last couple years. It's just they're either being coached by the wrong guys or they are the wrong guys. Because it ain't getting done with this group right now.
I think the frustrating thing is that, you know, I'll say that, hey, you don't have to have all pros across the board. It's good enough to have a couple of studs and a few journeymen. But in this scheme, the frustrating thing is that usually you actually do get some really good performances out of average offensive linemen if they're good for the scheme and if it's being coached right. That's where I think in the offseason, if they don't make a change at offensive coordinator, I'll be astounded if they don't make a change at offensive line coach.
Agreed.
And it's almost, I mean, this comes back to D'Amico's hiring. Chris Strausser never coached in a system like this. You talk to offensive linemen, this goes back to when I was playing against this scheme or talking to Gary Kubiak about it. It's way more complicated than just what you draw up on the board. Somebody once told me that it was, you know, you can learn the playbook in a half hour. It'll take you decades to really learn how to block all of it.
Yes.
And there's a lot of technique involved. There's a lot of mental work involved. And when you have an offensive line coach who's never coached in a system like this before, it's hard to pick up on the fly and expect that he's all of a sudden going to be an Alex Gibbs senior. It's not that simple or easy.
Anybody who's ever been in management at any level, not just in football, but in business, knows hiring is a skill that you get better at over time. You get better at hiring people over time. Like, and it's normal, I think, for first-time head coaches. It's normal for them to have a list of guys they would want to go coach with. You know, like D'Amico's probably been putting his list together during his time in San Francisco through the years.
Yeah.
I'd be shocked if he hadn't been. Like, if any of these coaches, college or pro, don't have a list of guys, like, boy, when I get my head coaching job, these are my first 10 phone calls I'm making because I want this guy. We've talked about it at all the clinics we've been to. Someday we're going to coach together. Bobby and D'Amico probably talked about it in those rooms when they were quality control guys. Like, someday. Doesn't mean they're the right guys. You know, like, you get better at hiring over time, and I think that's got to be the hope if you're a Texan fan, is that the same way you hope that CJ improves at this, or Nico improves at that, or Will Anderson Jr. gets better at the top of his edge rush, you hope that D'Amico Ryans gets better at identifying coaching talent and what fits what he wants to do here.
The other thing that happens with coaching is that the problem is people have contracts. And a lot of times your dream list of offensive line coaches, you know, the top five guys on there, there's a good chance they're all under contract, you know? Hey, Jeff Stoutland, the Eagles offensive line coach, probably not getting fired anytime soon. You know, it's just like he's not there. The one thing that's curious to me about the Texans' run game is that I don't believe they have a run game coordinator specifically. And, I don't know what's going to happen with Kyle Shanahan, but Chris Forrester is the offensive line coach and run game coordinator for the 49ers. He's been around forever. And that's a guy where hopefully he's on D'Amico's list.
Yeah.
That, all right, guys that could become available this offseason that if you got a chance, just money whip that dude. Get a guy in here who actually knows what he's doing. If you're not going to make a change at coordinator.
Agreed. All right, let's do some little positivity here. Acknowledge some big performances from over the weekend. We need the music there, Jordan. There we go. All right, so the way this works, if you listen on Mondays, you know, we acknowledge big performances or things we liked from over the weekend. Sometimes we acknowledge long-term performance in retirement. That'll happen in this segment right here. But I read a name Jordan, who's producing today, plays...
Acknowledge me!
And we acknowledge why we are acknowledging these people. Let's start with Saquon Barkley.
Acknowledge me!
We acknowledge Saquon Barkley, Seth, for becoming the ninth running back in NFL history to go over 2,000 yards in a season. He is 105 yards away from Eric Dickerson's single-season record. We will acknowledge as well that it's a 17-game season now, not a 16-game season like it was with Eric Dickerson back in the day. But it's fair to say that the Saquon Barkley acquisition is working out as well as the Eagles possibly could have imagined and as poorly as the New York Giants possibly could have imagined.
Yeah, the one thing that John Mara didn't want to have happen, but his GM kept telling him it has to happen for so many good reasons. Because most of all, let's be real, Saquon Barkley is washed up. He's 27 years old. What could you expect to get out of him?
Why would you pay?
And who's going to want him?
Right.
He also said that multiple times. Who's going to want him anyway?
Right, we can't trade him.
Turns out
the Eagles wanted him. Would you pay for that? I believe one of the other quotes uttered. We're going to hear some of the audio here in a second. One of the other quotes uttered by Joe Shane: do I want to pay $40 million to my quarterback to hand off to a $12 million running back?
Right.
I'll point out that $40 million quarterback is a Minnesota Viking now. He's not even on the Giants anymore. He's not even a Giant. Here's probably the most noteworthy exchange between Giants GM Joe Shane. This is from Hard Knocks offseason. Giants GM Joe Shane and owner of the Giants and probably the biggest Saquon Barkley fan in the world, John Mara.
What's the latest?
Just on the Saquon thing.
I just got a text that Chicago's driving the price up and Philly's out. I don't know if that's true or not.
Liar.
Which I don't know. I'll make a couple calls. I don't even know if that's going to happen. But
I have a tough time sleeping if Saquon goes to Philadelphia. I'll tell you that. As I've told you, just being out. I have been around enough players. But he's the most popular player we have by far.
Yeah.
Yeah, Joe Shane didn't want to hear about popularity. that was not registering. The more we play that cut, the more Joe Shane in the very beginning sounds like a guy who is totally lying and doesn't even. He just thinks like this old man's going to believe me. He'll believe me.
I'll tell you, man. Just that right there, there's so many moments from that Hard Knocks where these are conversations that would have been had, we just wouldn't have been privy to them.
Right, right.
So, like, let's pretend that this was never on HBO Hard Knocks, but these were the conversations that Joe Shane is having with John Mara, where he's just continually, over the course of that HBO Hard Knocks offseason, kind of pulling the wool over John Mara's eyes about the situation. And Joe Shane is repeatedly telling people on his own staff, no, nobody's going to want him. Why would Philly want Saquon Barkley? No, they're not going to go after him. So, like, he was so wrong in so many respects, which happens, except that you also get a sense that, man, it felt like he was actively misleading him.
Oh, yeah.
Like, actively 100%. Misleading John Mara.
100%.
And not to mention, but then not even misleading it, saying, we've got to find out what we have in Daniel Jones, the guy that I paid without apparently knowing what we have in him.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's gone, which is what's so crazy about these reports that Joe Shane's job is safe.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
It's crazy.
Somebody's got to grab John Mara by his little fancy lad prep school blazer and say he is making a fool of you, John Mara.
You can act like a man.
Yes.
All right, let's keep it moving. Coach Prime.
Acknowledge me.
I'm going to acknowledge Coach Prime, not for the abysmal performance that Colorado put up in the Alamo Bowl. BYU just took them to the woodshed. And that was with Shador playing quarterback and Travis Hunter playing wide receiver and cornerback. Colorado's guys played in this game, and I will... A partial portion of my acknowledgement is to Coach Prime for having his guys play in the bowl game. I think that's really cool. Now, they played like they were out a lot on the Riverwalk over the last few days. They were not good. This is what has me acknowledging Coach Prime, and this is where I've really come around on him this year as a coach and a leader of young kids, you know, young men, I should say. This was Coach Prime giving his opinion on something he thinks should be mandatory for college football play, college athletes.
I think financial literacy classes should be mandatory so these kids understand how to manage their money when they get their money, and I think it should be a pay scale. It should be structured. It can't be just Tom, Dick, and Harry gets this because he had a great year somewhere else, then that throws off the chemistry and the structure of your whole team. It's just like one of you guys coming out here and some guys from outside come in here and they make more money than you and they hadn't even been doing the work that you've done. It's not fair. And I think the NFL has handled it right, and we need to mimic the NFL when it comes to that, because right now we're not pros, but we're semi-pro. And that's the way it's going. And if we don't get a hold of it, it's going to keep going left. And the teams that don't have the budgets like us, it's going to be hard to sit up here in front of you and then make it to a playoff game, because now it turns into pay-per-view.
That's good. We're good, Jordan. That's right. That's good right there. The last about 30 seconds of that, he's basically saying that college needs a salary cap like the NFL. Like, all teams need to be playing.
Oh, that's what he says.
He goes
on to say that. Yeah.
No, no.
Yeah,
I felt like that's what he was implying by saying the pros got it right. Now we need to mimic the pros.
Oh, I thought he meant in terms of the literacy classes and everything, because there's all kinds of stuff in the off season about educational stuff like that.
Oh, okay, okay. That probably, maybe that too.
That makes, I mean, given what he was talking about, that's what I assumed he was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the Wild West right now in college. And yeah, I mean, from program to program, who knows, like, how many of those guys even realize that they've got to pay self-employment tax and all that, and it's a lot. It's hard enough when you actually get a real job with an employer, you know, to manage your taxes.
Yeah.
But, like, you're all of a sudden making all that money as an independent contractor with all this NIL stuff, and it's a lot. But then the part that I was intrigued by was when he was talking about the jealousy and everything. Like, that's almost like a financial literacy and philosophy class in one.
Yeah.
Just, you know, understanding and not comparing yourself to others and keeping your eyes on the... It would be very tailored to professional athletes.
I think financial literacy courses should be mandatory in college, period, for every student. I think there's always mandatory. I had to take two theology courses at Notre Dame. Yeah, I had to take PE my freshman year.
Look at how fit and pious you are now because of it.
Right. I never had to at any point. I mean, I was a finance major, but there were no mandatory financial classes. You know,
it is like, funny. Yeah, I think like you can take any number of macro and microeconomics classes, but still not be good about managing your own personal.
Yeah,
finances.
I think it should. Yeah. I think the syllabus should be totally putting the student in the shoes of this is their money, not. This is the economy, you know?
I remember when we were in school, at some point, you know, they had home economics and you had shop class. And they changed it to where they were like, all right, like, listen, times are changing. And I'm guessing a lot of these young women in the 1980s aren't going to go on to be housewives. I think we called it home and careers. So it was like, we could still take shop or tech ed, whatever they called it. But there was a separate one that was home and careers, which was everybody took it and you had to learn how to do all the old home economic stuff like cooking and everything. But then there was also balancing your checkbook. There was a financial management side to it.
Yeah.
But it was in like seventh or eighth grade.
Right.
So where it's not quite getting to the point where, you know, you don't have your own checkbook at that point usually. That's at the very, like, your junior or senior year in high school is probably the best time to do that.
Yeah. So Coach Prime, good job on your philosophy. Bad job in the Alamo Bowl. Good job with what you're espousing. Jonathan Fagan. Hey, Jordan. Jonathan Fagan.
Acknowledge me.
We acknowledge Jonathan Fagan. Jonathan Fagan, Rockets beat writer for the Houston Chronicle, hanging it up after 27 years of covering the Rockets. And even longer than that with the Chronicle. I can remember when I moved here in like 1994, 1995, and Jonathan Fagan was doing periodic radio over on one of Dan Patrick's stations, I think with Matt Thomas back in the day. So he's been doing it in Houston even longer than the several, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, even longer than the 27 years he's been covering the team. But man, you can tell a lot, Seth, about the respect level by the way the team that a person covers handles their retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan Fagan got an ad a full page ad in the Chronicle from the Rockets. Ime Udoka tossed a basketball to Jonathan Fagan in the post game press conference after they blew that lead to the Timberwolves on Friday. That was Fagan's last game, I believe. And they honored him last night at the Heat game. You know, center court gave him, you know, I don't recall what they gave him, but they acknowledged him at the game right there at center court. I don't know, Jonathan, really. I probably did a few of those like panel shows with him along the way on TV. You know, you and I have done enough TV. I don't know that he's ever been part of the 610 family here, at least not while I've been here. I always enjoyed reading his stuff. He was excellent. You couldn't ask for anybody better at covering your local basketball team.
No, and I like honestly, the simplest thing is what I've always appreciated him the most for is just the game recaps. Like I feel like he does it. He did a really good job of just laying it out exactly what the pertinent issues were, without hopping around all over the place. A lot of these young writers are so enamored of all the stats and everything that it turns out it feels like you're reading an advanced box score the whole time. They then throw in a couple of transitions too and call it an article. Like Fagan would write actual articles every night. And you feel like, oh yeah, that was the most important thing in this game. Yeah. Or that was the critical moment in this game. Yes. Thank you, John.
Usable for guys like us, especially guys like us if it was a West Coast game. And we didn't see the whole thing. I'm not gonna lie. Yeah, like his recaps were awesome. So congrats to Jonathan Fagan, who it sounds like is going to do a lot of traveling in retirement from everything that I've read. He had a really good kind of like final piece that he wrote thanking everybody. If you're a fan of Jonathan Fagan or you're a fan of the Rockets, go out of your way to find it. It was really, really good. Congratulations to him on a great career in an industry where it is really hard to go out on your own terms. And he's going out on his own terms. So good for him.
He should have thrown the ball back to Udoka, like he's checking the ball.
In the press.
Just rifle it back at him aggressively.
If they'd won that game, then maybe. Like, blew a 16-point lead. Greg Gumbel.
Acknowledge me.
R.I.P. Greg Gumbel passes away over the weekend. If you're a sports fan at all in town, you know Greg Gumbel because it feels like he called 100 Texans games over the last several years. Passes away in his late 70s. Cancer. He'd been suffering from cancer over the last several months, year or two maybe. He'd been off the air for a while. I would say Seth synonymous with March Madness. That's probably the thing he's most known for is hosting that studio show with whoever through the years. But the last few years, it's been Kenny Smith, Charles Barkley, Clark Kellogg. Obviously a big part of the NFL coverage. He was part of the nearly original group at SportsCenter back in the day in the 80s. That's where I graduated high school with his daughter, because he worked in Bristol.
That's right,
he worked in Bristol, Connecticut, so they lived in my town. So Michelle Gumbel is a classmate of mine. Probably best known in Houston, or maybe not best known, but if as far as like Houston calls go that are iconic, Greg Gumbel on the Kiss of Death in 1995.
LA out of the corner for three.
And him talk to the Phoenix bench. How wide open was Akeem Olajuwon on the play, though?
Mario Elie, is that the stake through the heart for a second straight season by the Houston Rockets?
There you go. Kiss of death, man. I would say one of the three or four most famous plays in the history of this city, the Mario Elie kiss of death. And Greg Gumbel was the one on the call for that one.
And also, Jimmy Carter passed away yesterday as well.
Let's acknowledge Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter.
Acknowledge me.
100. He made it to triple digits, right? He was a hundo.
Yeah, he was in rough shape the last few years.
Yes.
Always, you know, when people have Alzheimer's. He's just from a personal standpoint, he was the first president that I was ever aware of that was a president. Because I was 5 years old in 1980, so I was like old enough to know who the president was and that there was going to be a new president. That was all I knew.
I
don't know who the hell Gerald Ford was. I was an infant when he was. Gerald Ford was the first president you were like consciously aware of.
Consciously aware of. I mean, I remember my parents like when I was real little saying stuff about Nixon resigning, like, but I didn't really gather what that was all about.
Yeah,
like Gerald Ford was we elect these officials when they don't resign.
I knew my grandparents were the most political people I knew. So all I knew of Jimmy Carter was that I was not supposed to like Jimmy Carter, which is, hey, that's politics, baby.
it is politics. All right. Look, we can sit here and talk about our issues on offense with the Houston Texans. We can take a look up north and say, well, thankfully, this isn't us. The exit strategy has begun for a former Texan. We will have that for you coming up next.
Payne and Pendergast is driven by West Point Lincoln at Katy Freeway. 1 mile west of the Beltway, exit Kirkwood, under the giant American flag. It's to Shoppers John Deere Reaction Monday on Sports Radio 610. Live from the Twin Peaks Studios, here's Payne and Pendergast.
We're going to hand things over to John Harris and Mark Vandermeer in just a little bit. Hey, quick update. We didn't get to this in headlines, but quick update. Up in Cleveland, they've still got roughly $170 million worth of cap dollars allocated to Deshaun Watson spread out over God knows how many years, with voidable years and everything else.
Yeah.
They did a little restructure over the last few days. Here's Ian Rapoport of the NFL Network.
We've, as it pertains to their quarterback position, agreed in terms with Deshaun Watson on an adjusted contract. No, he did not give up his $92 million fully guaranteed. What this did was ease the cap burden in a couple years in the event he is no longer the quarterback for them. But what this really did was make sure everyone knew Deshaun Watson will be back in Cleveland next year. I would expect some competition, though. Wouldn't be surprised if it's veteran competition. Aaron Rodgers, if he's not on the Jets, would be one potential option. Kirk Cousins, Rich, another one.
I am so here for Deshaun Watson competing for a starting position in the NFL next training camp.
And who, you know what, though? Maybe, who knows? Maybe that'll end up being what's best for him.
It might be.
There is still, if I'm in Cleveland, you got to talk yourself into things. And you know that there's a high ceiling with Deshaun Watson. Somewhere in there is the guy who is still young. He's still young. That has had a lot of promise and played really well in a lot of regards in 2020. But where the Browns are right now with him, yeah, if they could, they would. If they could part with him, they would. But you know what this is, Sean? This is like trying to get divorced during COVID. Remember the divorce rates just plummeted? And it was like, because there's so much stuff going on. Now, a lot of seeds were planted for getting divorced in the future, I'm sure.
And they will get divorced in the future as well.
Yeah, right. But during COVID, I mean, people were like, the finances were dicey.
Yeah.
It was hard to even schedule an appointment with anybody that could help you get divorced. It was just, the divorce rates plummeted like 54%.
Yeah.
And then they rebounded very quickly post-COVID. But yeah, that's where they are. They're in the middle of a bad marriage in the middle of COVID, and the finances just won't allow them to divorce. So they got to try to make do and just not murder each other because they're trapped in the same room with each other for however long the Deshaun Watson contract pandemic lasts.
Deshaun Watson's contract is a pandemic, is what it is. It's a pandemic. Yeah. And so without getting into the nerdy details of what Cleveland and Deshaun agreed to, none of the overall money changes. He's still getting his $92 million that he's guaranteed. Not a penny more, not a penny less. They just kind of spread it out differently. Texans cap sent me a long summary of what it all means. And basically it means they're going to be together for another couple years because it's impossible for a team to take as big a cap hit as the Browns would take to get rid of him. But when the time does come to move on, unless he plays well in 2025 or 2026, maybe he does. Maybe he gets right. Who the hell knows? But if this is all going the direction we anticipate it's going, the eventual release of Deshaun Watson, while painful, can be at least spread out with some June 1st kind of stuff and things like that when 2027 rolls around. This is the worst contract in the history of team sports. It's so bad. And they've handled it so bad by jamming so much of it into the future.
The Broncos giving all that money to Russell Wilson was weird, and it was bad, but they could recover from it.
They have.
Whereas this one, obviously. No, well, from the financial side, they're still suffering the ramifications of it, but still, they were able to move on within a couple years.
They're winning games,
Right. Where this is just, it's impossible because it was all guaranteed. It was a bold move, and it just blew up in their faces spectacularly.
It was a bold move.
We'll see.
You never know.
I'm not going to be sitting here and acting like, nope, Deshaun Watson's all washed up, no chance, and then the Texans play them next year. I got no taste for that.
Throws for 350. I'm with you on that.
Yeah. There's still that Deshaun Watson is in there somewhere.
It's like Darth Vader. There's good in him still.
Yes.
So D'Amico's meeting with the media today at 12:30, I believe. He's going to get asked about CJ playing in this game. What do you think the answer is? Do you think?
Oh, he's going to hold it close to his vest and not say anything. Yeah. And then they're going to have given the dirty eye to Aaron Wilson. Waiting to see.
Oh, for breaking the news?
Just waiting to see until he breaks the news or whatever. Now, this one, maybe they won't play it super close to the vest just because it's you don't really gain anything from winning or losing this game. So they might, for CJ's sake, if CJ doesn't play in this game, I'm guessing he's going to have to be talked into it. Mm-hmm. And I saw this clip of Ryan Fitzpatrick this weekend, and I tried to go back and find it this morning, and I couldn't. But he was on Andrew Whitworth's podcast, and Fitzpatrick was talking about a time where he had tried to play through a rib injury, and he just didn't want to come off the field. He felt he owed it to the team, and it was his responsibility to play. And he said in hindsight, he realized, all right, at that point, I was hurting the team. And I like it sounds like a weird thing to say, but I kind of hope CJ is really banged up right now, because that is an explanation, at least a partial explanation, for how bad he was the other night.
Yeah.
And that it's the best thing for the team for him to get as healthy as possible. Yeah. So if they go out there and he says it today, it just like CJ can be at peace with it, not have to worry about it, not have to lie to the media about it, just roll into this whole week making Davis Mills the guy.
Yep, we'll see. 12:15, by the way. 12:15 is D'Amico Ryan's today. I'm sure you'll hear it, at least portions of it, right here during In the Loop on Sports Radio 610. Seth, we got to hand it over to John and Mark. Antibodies to you, my friend.
Antibodies to you as well, and I hope you don't get divorced during the next pandemic.
Should not, but I think I'm in good shape, especially after Christmas. I think I'm doing good.
Good. Good job.
Thank you.
Big spender.
All right. We are done. We are out of time. Thanks to Jordan for producing today. Seth, we'll see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. John Harris and Mark Vandermeer, they're up next. It's a Texans Monday here on Sports Radio 610. See you tomorrow, everybody.